If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The right to express thoughts and opinions, no matter how unpalatable or controversial, has been one of the key components of democratic societies across centuries. Yet, as author Jacob Mashangara explores in his new book, Free Speech, A Global History from Socrates to Social Media, it's a principle that has been attacked and lauded in equal measure. Jacob spoke to Matt Elton about the key moments and figures in the history of a vital, challenging idea.
Your book covers this huge expanse of human history and sort of tells the story of a fundamental tension that's run throughout cultures across that span. Can you just talk us through what your book covers and where you see the roots of that tension is emerging, I suppose?
Yeah, so it's an attempt to sketch a history of free speech and goes all the way back to ancient times. And as you rightly say, I find a tension between what we might call an egalitarian conception of free speech and an elitist conception of free speech. And the egalitarian one has its roots in the Athenian democracy, so 2,500 years ago. So if you go to Thucydides' account of Pericles' famous funeral oration, he talks about how the Athenians like to debate things before they rush into action. And he paints sort of a picture of tolerance between citizens. You also have an orator like Demosthenes who mentions free speech in a number of his surviving speeches and very much sees this as a paramount value of the Athenians. Of course, the fate of Socrates shows that free speech was not an absolute value for the Athenians. In fact, it's never been an absolute value for any human society ever, not even in our liberal democracies, as we might get back to. But that's where I find the origins of free and equal speech. And you can contrast that with the Roman Republic, where you have a much more, I would say, regimented, top-down, elitist conception of free speech. So you don't have, as opposed to the Athenian democracy, you don't have ordinary people being able to speak in popular assemblies. And it's mostly sort of an elite that exercises free speech and not what would be considered the mob by people like Cicero and Cato, these type of people who saw themselves as an elite who were sufficiently educated to exercise free speech, as opposed to the ordinary plebs.
So in that second model, in the elitist model, there is free speech, but there are certain groups of people who get to decide who gets to have free speech. Is that right?
That is right. And of course, I should say that these are the societies that even that acknowledge free speech. Then throughout the majority of human history, most societies have not acknowledged free speech at all. And so I would say that free speech, of course, is when you have authoritarian or even totalitarian states, free speech is not a value at all. These societies are almost defined by their absence of free speech. It would be very difficult to imagine Putin being able to launch the war with the propaganda that went before it if there had been free and equal speech in Russia. I think his sort of aggression depended to a certain extent on the ability to control the public sphere, to silence dissent, and to basically limit the public sphere to official propaganda.
When free speech is possible, has been possible, are those two models something that we can see intertwining throughout the history of humankind ever since that moment?
I think so. I think these two conceptions, in various manifestations, of course, you see this conflict throughout history, and especially at times when you have new technological or political developments that tend to expand the public sphere, so basically allow new constituencies or into the public sphere. So that could be, for instance, the printing press is a good example. The printing press suddenly allows ordinary people access to read and write and publish, and you no longer have a small elite. But it could also be political developments. So the expansion of the public sphere through democratic rights to the poor and propertyless, to women, to racial and religious minorities, and so on. And what tends to happen at such circumstances is that those who serve as the institutional gatekeepers, those who are the elites that enjoy a privileged access to free speech, tend to panic about the consequences of expanding the public sphere. And I think British history is a particularly strong example of that. But even now in our digital age, I think we see that clash very strongly, sort of in the way that democracies have sort of fallen out of love with the internet and social media, and even liberal democratic states are sort of rushing to try and impose some kind of top-down control of the public sphere, out of a fear of what will happen if everyone, or even the most extreme voices or disinformation and so on, is allowed to flow freely.
Mm. So there really are echoes, you think, across that whole of time?
Yes, very much so, yes. Mm.
I wanted to talk about some of the sort of the forces and the figures behind some of these patterns, if you like. I was particularly struck in your exploration of medieval period in this regard. You mentioned a lot of Islamic thought, which I thought was really striking. Do you think that culture, those cultures, are particularly interesting to study in terms of free speech?
I think the Abbasid Caliphate, which emerged around 750, is interesting, not because it sort of established free speech. It didn't. These were not sort of democratic rulers, and nor were they sort of tolerant based on our standards. But what is really striking is that they, partly because of a lack of an ability to impose sort of strong centralized rules, so the Abbasid Caliphate and adjacent territories become a very fertile ground for these striking polymaths and philosophers. And also there's a concerted effort to translate Greek philosophy and science, which then very much helps create a flourishing philosophical and scientific environment in these Islamic lands, and also contributes to the so-called rediscovery of Greek philosophy in the West later on, sparking the 12th century Renaissance and so on. So I think it is quite interesting. And I think, you know, you have some of the probably the most radical free thinkers of the medieval period in the Islamic land. So someone like Ibn al-Rawandi and Razi, people who essentially reject prophecy, reject holy books, who extol reason as sort of the supreme measure of things, which goes much further than what anyone in the West was thinking at the time, at least from the surviving sources. So in that sense, I think the Islamic world plays an important, if often overlooked, role, even if it would go too far to sort of argue that in the Abbasid Caliphate, you know, they had a constitutional protection of free speech. They didn't, but they certainly contributed to the idea of freedom of inquiry and philosophical freedom.
Moving to sort of Europe around this period, how do ideas of religion and heresy, I suppose, feed into how free speech was treated at this time?
I have a chapter which I call The Not-So-Dark Ages, but I think there's sort of two strikingly contrasting development. So on the one hand, you have the emergence of universities in Western Europe, and these places attract brilliant scholars who very much are interested in pagan philosophy. And recent, so Aristotle, of course, becomes sort of the game changer. And initially, there's this attempt by universities and also the church to sort of say, have these speech codes, as we might call them today, you know, say, oh no, we can't have, you know, Aristotelian philosophy because, you know, he's a pagan and that runs contrary to orthodoxy. But then it comes almost like a competitive advantage for universities to be allowed to use pagan philosophy, and some of these scholars are then poached by other universities. and it becomes just impossible to keep it out. And so I think that during this period, there's some striking philosophical and scientific developments that point towards the later periods that we call sort of the scientific revolution and so on, that where we really have to look at the medieval period and sort of the expansion of the permissible limits of inquiry and reason. Of course, at the same time, you also have very strict attempts to regiment belief, orthodoxy. So you have these attempts to root out heresy. So it's one thing to have, you know, a small class of scholars at these universities who communicate with one another, but it's another thing to have the ordinary population adopt heretical views that might really challenge the authority of church and state. And so you have what is called the medieval Inquisition, and you have inquisitors setting up shop around Europe, in Germany, France, and so on, sometimes using rather brutal methods of imprisonment, of torture, and ultimately, in certain cases, even the burning of heretics. So the medieval period, in that sense, is striking in that on the one hand, you have this development where the permissible limits of inquiry and reason are expanded dramatically at universities. And on the other hand, you have the church trying to impose orthodoxy on ordinary Europeans.
So the fear still is that too much free speech might destabilize society.
Yeah, and of course they would not think in the terminology of free speech, because that terminology didn't survive. The Athenian concepts of free and equal speech did not really survive. They were changed through the success of Christianity, so they wouldn't have recognized a conception of free speech. But I think how much of this is the church sort of trying to shore up its own power, and how much of it is genuine fear of, because I think it's difficult for modern human beings to understand the extent to which religion dominated the thought of people at the time. So I think that for many of these people who wanted to punish heretics, they would not see it as we tend to see it as something that is borderline evil, but they would see it as doing something for the common good. They would mark out these people who were essentially threatening the survival of communities, because they were polluting Christendom with these impure heretical ideas that could ultimately lead to divine intervention, to the wrath of God, and he could then strike down on communities, and ultimately that would have devastating consequences for innocent people.
You mentioned at the start the invention of the printing press in the 15th century. Just how seismic a moment was that for this story?
I think it's an absolute game changer. So initially, the Catholic Church looks upon the printing press as a divine instrument, because it allows the Catholic Church to spread its message much more efficiently, and sort of to, this is orthodoxy. And so, yeah, so it's a divine instrument. But then comes along an honorary constipated German monk called Martin Luther, who suddenly challenges the authority of the church and finds that in fact it's the Catholic Church and its teachings misrepresents Christianity, whereas he has identified the true Christianity, and no one can even come close to competing with Martin Luther. He's so prolific, he's industrious. He writes a flood of pamphlets, and they're just reproduced. And sold throughout Europe. No one comes close to competing to him. And he revolutionizes the way of communicating. You might call it religious populism, in the sense that he'll write in German rather than Latin. He'll write these short, punchy treatises rather than sort of dry theological treatises. He'll use memes, cartoons that appeal to emotions. And so ordinary people he appeals to their instincts and feelings and emotions. And that's, of course, why the Protestant Reformation takes off. But again, it's interesting to look at Luther because, you know, at one point you might say, well, Martin Luther is a champion of freedom of conscience. And to a certain extent, that is true. So when he's summoned before the emperor and sort of asked to recant, he says, well, show me where in the Bible I'm wrong and I'll recant. But no pope or no Catholic Church has the authority to change my views unless, you know, you can point to where in scripture I'm mistaken. And that, of course, is a striking moment in the history of freedom of conscience. But again, I think it's important to notice that at this point of history, the idea of universal freedom of conscience or free speech was not accepted. And so Martin Luther was not someone who then said, well, everyone should just be allowed to believe whatever they want. So he's appalled, of course, by the unintended consequences of his reformation, because he puts a lot of emphasis on the ability of ordinary people to read and write. But what happens when ordinary people learn how to read and write? You read the Bible, and suddenly you might not come to the same conclusions and interpretations as Martin Luther himself. And suddenly you have an alphabet soup of various sects, some of them with crazy ideas that Martin Luther, is completely against. You know, you have German peasants rebelling against their princes, something which certainly was not what Martin Luther had intended. And then he himself comes around to arguing in favor of censorship, even, you know, the death penalty for blasphemy. And towards the end of his life, he writes these ragingly anti-Semitic pamphlets on the Jews and their lies, where he argues for sort of the burning of synagogue and so on. But the unintended consequences of Protestant Reformation are huge. But I think we should be careful about, you know, if we could resurrect Martin Luther and take him to 2022, I don't think he would be a fan of our modern concept of free speech and freedom of religion. That was certainly not what he intended.
That's so interesting. He's a key figure, and another key figure who is a sort of concept that you weave throughout the book, interestingly, is John Milton. Can you explain to listeners who John Milton was and what you mean by Milton's curse?
Yes. Well, John Milton is, of course, celebrated because he's a great poet, of course. But when it comes to free speech, he is the author of Areopagitica from 1644, which is a protest against the reintroduction of licensing, so pre-publication censorship in 1643. Milton's work is often seen as one or even the first writing against censorship and in favor of press freedom. I don't think that's, strictly speaking, correct. It's become very famous, and justly so, I think, because it's a very eloquent defense of press freedom, Areopagitica, and many of the arguments advanced by John Milton are evergreen and very much worth repeating today. But as with Martin Luther, you know, the devil's in the detail. So Milton, being a Puritan, was not in favor of press freedom for all. He was not a sort of a universalist conception of free speech. He was, in fact, very insistent that Catholics should certainly not enjoy this, nor should, atheists or other with dangerous ideas. You know, I think you could argue that first and foremost, Milton was concerned about the ability of mainline Protestant sects to debate theological and political differences with each other without having to fear censorship. And so the reason why I call it Milton's curse is because we see this tendency throughout the history of free speech, where some of the champions of free speech have advanced free speech, but only for certain groups or only on certain subjects, or they sort of come around to making what from our point of view seem as hypocritical stance on free speech, so compromising their stance on free speech. And unfortunately, Milton is just but one example of that.
Why does that happen? Why do we find these heroes of free speech who end up compromising that somehow?
I think that in a certain sense, intolerance is hardwired into human beings. So in many ways, I think free speech is a counterintuitive and very difficult principle for human beings, especially when we sense that people hold ideas and express ideas that are seen as dangerous to the values that we hold the most dear, or the values that are seen as holding together society, that are absolutely necessary for social cohesion. At one point, that was religious ideas, but today, you know, it might be racist or disinformation that we see as threatening our modern liberal democratic values, and that we then become intolerant of. But what I think is interesting is contrasting Milton with the so-called levelers, because they're his contemporaries, and so people like Richard Overton and William Waldwin and John Lilburn, who actually argue for quite a radical defense of free speech, not only against pre-publication censorship, but even for the protection of free speech as such. And in a much broader, I would argue that they have a much broader conception of free speech than John Milton. And of course, John Milton ends up serving as a censor under Cromwell himself, whereas the levelers end up being imprisoned when they criticize the Cromwell regime. So I've never quite understood why the levelers have sort of been forgotten in the history of free speech, whereas Milton is seen as this great champion. I think that had the levelers' conception of free speech won back in the 1640s, the history of free speech would have progressed much, much faster towards our current ideals than what was the case.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The idea of free speech unites them against the British. That unity does not survive independence, but at the time, it really becomes one of the great rallying cries of the American Revolution.
Heading across the Atlantic to the United States, what does the foundation and evolution of that state, I suppose, tell us about free speech?
If you go to the 17th century and the colonies, there's not much trace of free speech at the time. So in 1671, Virginia's governor, William Berkeley, sort of summed up the prevailing attitude to free speech and education among many colonial elites. So he says, "I thank God there are no free schools nor printing, and I hope we shall not have these 100 years, for learning has brought disobedience and heresy and sex into the world, and printing has divulged them and libels against the best government. God keep us from both." So this was sort of the prevailing attitude at the time, and you had rather strict punishments for seditious libel at the time. And even in colonies that allowed for religious toleration, sort of William Penn's Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Maryland, they did not allow for political free speech. William Penn, who was a political prisoner, essentially, was part of a political decision that sentenced someone to be whipped in the marketplace of Philadelphia. But in the 18th century, I think there's a huge change, not least through the spread of Cato's letters. So these are these letters written by these British radical Whigs. And one of them is Cato's letter number 15, which, and this goes viral in the colonies. And then in 1735, you have a very famous case called the Sanger case. So basically, a public official in New York tries to have some of his critics imprisoned or for seditious libel. And he ultimately drags the publisher in a court. But the jury court refuses to convict the publisher, even though under British common law, he was clearly guilty. And then it becomes basically impossible for colonial authorities to convince American jury courts to convict their fellow citizens for political speech. So I would argue there's a a culture of free speech that develops in 18th century America, which leads towards the Revolutionary War and makes it impossible for British authorities to really quell the dissent that is brewing and which then explodes. And at the same time, free speech unites the patriot side. So they see themselves as fighting for free speech and against British slavery, which of course is a rather ironic term given that some of them were slaveholders themselves. But nonetheless, the idea of free speech unites them against the British. And that unity does not survive independence, but at the time, it really becomes one of the great rallying cries of the American Revolution.
As we head into the 19th century, are there any individuals or moments that you think we should highlight or that perhaps don't get the attention they deserve?
What I think is most interesting about the 19th century is this huge reaction across Europe against free speech. So, you know, during the Enlightenment in the 18th century, even absolutist rulers like Catherine the Great in Russia, like Joseph II in Austria, like Frederick the Great in Prussia, sort of saw free speech, or at least a limited conception of free speech, as essential for sort of Enlightenment values and progress. But then the French Revolution really changes everything. So once the French Revolution gets out of hand, you see a huge backlash against free speech. In Britain, of course, you see it already in sort of in the 1790s when Prime Minister Pitt sort of cracks down on Tom Paine and Paineite ideas for democratic reform with a number of really draconian laws to limit free speech and freedom of association. But after the Napoleonic Wars, the new, more reactionary and conservative order is cemented, and free speech becomes a victim very much of that. So you have these European states who so we have to put emphasis on authority, on tradition, on and religion, and no one should be allowed to challenge it. And even, you know, even in the UK, which of course does not go to the same lengths as in Russia, for instance, in suppressing free speech. You know, someone like Richard Carlyle, who's this radical who sells Tom Paine's works to the lower classes, spent something like 6 years in total in prison for seditious and blasphemous libel. And so you very much see this elitist conception of free speech dominating the first half of the 19th century in Europe and even in the UK. But ultimately, the idea that you can hold down free speech cannot be sustained. One reason is, you know, technological developments, the printing press has become more sophisticated. So it just becomes almost impossible for censors to keep up with the work. You know, you can't have pre-publication censorship of all the works that are being published, but also democratic ideals just gain more and more ground. They cannot be suppressed completely. And so I would say that the second half of the 19th century is where free speech really becomes integrated into a number of European states that also then veer towards more democratic forms of government.
So we've got these twin forces of increasing democracy and technological developments running through into the 20th century. Is there perhaps you could talk about a moment that you see as being a particular challenge for those forces?
Yes, I think that what I call the Weimar fallacy is a very interesting moment for the history of free speech because it still has huge ramifications for how we look at free speech in the 20th century in liberal democracies. And so basically the idea is that because the Nazis came to power through democratic means, even if they never gained an absolute majority, if only the Weimar Republic had been more intolerant of intolerance than perhaps the disaster of Nazism and of course the Holocaust could have been avoided. And that argument still undergirds a lot of laws restricting free speech in contemporary democracies. But I try to argue in the book, first of all, let me put out a disclaimer. I don't think that the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazism can be explained through the narrow prism of free speech and censorship. Quite clearly, there are many other factors in play, and some of those factors are likely much more important than free speech and censorship. However, what I show in the book is that the Weimar Republic adopted increasingly draconian laws to limit free speech of extremist movements like Nazis and communists. For instance, the radio was strictly regulated, so it was sort of mostly pro-government voices that could come on. Communists and Nazis were not allowed broadcast. And some of the most notoriously anti-Semitic Nazis were actually often prosecuted. So take someone like Goebbels, who later became propaganda minister. He founded Der Angriff, so a Nazi newspaper, because Adolf Hitler was prohibited from speaking in a number of German states. And Goebbels proudly proclaimed Der Angriff to be the most frequently banned daily in Germany, because there were these laws which allowed German states to administratively ban newspapers for up to 8 weeks if they published false information or if they attacked public officials or institutions or symbols of the government. And you also had the most depraved anti-Semitic Nazi, Julius Streicher, who was the editor of Der Stürmer. And he was twice convicted under this law that prohibited religious offense. And he was convicted for publishing these hideous blood libels that were obviously a way to incriminate or try to incriminate Jews, very much in line with his crude anti-Semitism. But what happened was that he was celebrated by his supporters when leaving court. And so less than a year after he was convicted in 1921 in Nuremberg, his hometown, the Nazis gained a huge increase of votes in Nuremberg. And so these developments and many others that I describe in the book suggest to me that the repression and censorship of the Nazis was not an efficient way to try and combat them. Now, I argue that it's interesting to look at the way that censorship was often used, but then that at the same time, the government was too weak to really crack down on the violent intimidation of these uniformed violent groups that roam around the streets. Maybe that would have been something that they should have spent more time on. And of course, you know, Adolf Hitler back in 1923 should have been put in prison for life for engaging in attempted violent coup. But the idea that in democracies you can clamp down on totalitarian movements, I don't think is supported by the actual events of Weimar Republic. And I think that should give pause to the slate of laws that we see in the 20th century, including in the UK and elsewhere, where democratic politicians want to crack down on racism and bigotry and so on through restricting free speech.
So you think the solution to those kind of social problems is not censorship, but instead other methods. Is that right?
Yes, I very much think so. I think, in fact, that, and this is, of course, one of the other, I think, main takeaways from the book is that today there's a dominant strain of thought which sees free speech as a threat to minorities and as a sort of consolidating unequal power relations. And I argue in the book that it's completely the other way around, that free speech and equality are not mutually exclusive, they are mutually reinforcing, and that every single persecuted group or minority has relied on free speech to further their cause and stake their claim for tolerance and acceptance, whereas every single oppressive state or authority has used censorship and repression to entrench their dominance of other groups. And the examples are many. So you could take 19th century America. So if you went to the southern states in the 1830s, they adopted some of the most draconian laws in American history. Some of them formally adopted the death penalty for advocating abolitionist ideas, whereas abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, this great African-American orator, was actually born a slave, argued that the right of speech is a very precious one, especially to the oppressed. And he protested vehemently when these white Bostonians disrupted a meeting in 1860 in Boston, where an abolitionist meeting, and he said that free speech is the difference between freedom and slavery. And I think that logic is very compelling. But you could also go to take the issue of British colonialism, for instance. So if you go to India, the Indian Penal Code, a number of speech crimes were introduced sort of against sedition and enmity and hatred against different classes. And they were used against Indian nationalists, including Mahatma Gandhi, who was sentenced to 6 years in prison in the early 1920s for advocating against British rule. And Gandhi actually advocates for a conception of free speech, which was much more speech protective than what was the state of the law in Britain and even in the United States at the time. You know, in 1921 or 22, when Gandhi was convicted, he says that, you know, everyone should be able to criticize any authority or institution as long as they don't promote or incite violence. But if you go to the United States at the time, people were being sent to prison for 10 or 20 years for opposing American involvement in World War I. And of course, in Britain, seditious laws were also frequently upheld. And one of the tragedies is that a number of British colonial speech crime laws, both in India but also in Hong Kong, have survived British colonialism and are now being used by, so in India, the Modi government, for instance, is using British era, colonial era laws against sedition to punish dissent. And the same is happening in Hong Kong. So that, I think, shows the danger of these laws. And at the same time, I think validates the idea that, you know, progress when it comes to tolerance and acceptance of minorities very much depends on the ability of those who are being oppressed to speak truth to power.
Do you think there are any dangers to unlimited free speech? And what are the challenges of trying to make that work, I suppose?
Oh, yes, of course. I think it's we must also be clear about the fact that, you know, free speech comes with costs and harms. It would be impossible to imagine a genocide, for instance, without speech being a component of it. And of course, you know, you could take the attack on the Capitol on January 6th in the United States. I think it would be very difficult to imagine that taking place without social media. But what I would argue is that when it comes to trying to mitigate those harms, restricting free speech through onerous laws and censorship is a cure worse than the disease. And that is something that is difficult for human beings to accept, because, you know, if there's a danger involved in certain kinds of speech, the logic next step is to say, oh, well, then we have to ban it. But as I've tried to show in the book, there are a number of unintended consequences, harmful consequences of that. Plus, it might even be counterproductive, and you might not get the results that you're aiming for. So, I think all supporters of free speech should acknowledge that free speech comes with costs and harms, and you know, those harms have become much more visible in the digital age of social media, where everyone can go online and spew hatred and crazy stuff. However, I think, you know, when we will look back at sort of the infancy of the age of social media, I think we will probably look at some of the laws and restrictions being imposed as constituting a sort of a 21st century version of elite panic that has dominated the history of free speech and is likely to break out now and again.
Finally, in these days of social media and state disinformation, how would you like your book to change how people see free speech, both now and in the past, I suppose?
Well, I think that, you know, we have a tendency in many of contemporary debates about free speech to look at whatever controversial issue it is through our specific feelings about the speech in question. I think that hopefully my book can help people have a more detached and cool approach to the principle of free speech and value it as such, and also sort of being able to distinguish between tolerance and approval, because the idea that you tolerate certain forms of speech does not mean that you approve of it. And then, you know, I think also I would encourage people who, like me, are skeptical about restrictions on free speech, even when it comes to racism and hatred and so on, to use their own voices to counter hatred and dangerous forms of speech, and provide visible solidarity to those who are the victims of such hatred. I think that creates a much more compelling case for the beneficial value of free speech.
That was Jacob Mashangara. Free Speech, A Global History from Socrates to Social Media is out now, published by Basic Books. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Daniel Kramer-Arden.